Vineyard Church Glendora presents this podcast of the weekend sermon given by Jacob Gaines.
Which is a more iconic line from Jerry Maguire, "You complete me or show me the money." I don't know. But we went with "show me the money" because it thematically seemed to fit a little bit better last week. And so I thought, why not begin our second week talking about money with another iconic clip in American cinematic history, which is a movie far different from Jerry Maguire, but will introduce today's theme nonetheless. And so, here we go. Okay, we'll stop there because then... because it doesn't get much better for him after that in the next few minutes. We'll end it there. But William Wallace, a.k.a. Mel Gibson, shouts what? Freedom. The prisoner wishes to speak. And what he shouts at the end of Braveheart is, in fact, this one word, freedom. And today, that's what I want to talk a little bit about. Today, I specifically want to talk about what William Wallace shouts, because it's how some of us felt that day we wrote the final student loan check, right? It's how some of us felt the day the car was perhaps paid off finally, or it's how you will feel perhaps the day that the final student loan check is written, or whatever it might be. And I want to talk specifically today about financial freedom. I want to talk about freedom as it pertains to money and our finances versus the alternative, which would, of course, be financial slavery. And perhaps at the end of today's talk, before you go out and eat soup, you will feel so moved as to grab your wallets and shout as William Wallace shouts at the top of your lungs, freedom, when it comes to my money. I'm assuming a couple of things right up front today. I want to start with two assumptions. Number one, I'm assuming that if I asked who in the room desires to be financially free or desires freedom when it comes to finances, I'm guessing most hands would go up in the room. That the vast majority of us in the room, we would start with the assumption we all desire financial freedom. It's all something that we would want. The second assumption then, I would assume, is that there are some in the room who feel like you are anything but free when it comes to your finances. And I'm going to assume that this lack of freedom is what honestly inspires or feeds incredible fear. Maybe it is the substantial debt that kind of hangs over you like an ever-present reminder that you are in some way enslaved to someone named J.P. Morgan or whoever Fannie Mae is. She owns a bit of you, correct? And so whatever that debt is, whatever that amount is, that in some way you feel like, yes, I do not feel free. I feel like my finances are somehow controlled by a bank or an institution or a lending institution, whatever it might be. Or maybe you feel like a slave to perpetual lack of budgeting, or what seems to be a propensity towards unwise spending habits, or maybe it was an investment that went terribly wrong, like that one time a few years back when your cousin gave you that sweet hot tip to stock tip to invest all of your savings in Blockbuster Video. And you were like, "Are you sure?" "Yes, this one will never fail. This one's going gold. This is going to be like Apple or Amazon." And you put it all in Blockbuster, and now you're wondering why. And so perhaps you feel like a slave to some bad decisions, or just no budget whatsoever. It's just wanton, wasteful spending at its finest. Regardless of where you might find yourself, I'm assuming some of us do not feel like we're living in freedom. And this lack of freedom has probably become like a drip line of fear. And every month it's just drip, drip, drip. It's a constant drip line of fear with every bill cycle, with every credit card cycle, with every student loan payment that comes due, car loan payment that comes due, mortgage that comes due, health, with every health emergency or health expense that comes due. It's just this constant reminder, is it not? Like a drip line of fear, drip, drip, drip. It's fear, and it's all based or rooted in our finances. So two things I would say then to those two assumptions right up front. Number one, I would say this, you are not alone. If that describes you, if I, in any way, shape, or form, I have described you in the last few minutes when it comes to money or finances, know that in this room today, you're not alone. In the immortal words of the Family Feud, our survey said a few weeks ago that this is, in fact, maybe the greatest fear in the room, that more of you circled fear of finances, fear of money, than any other fear that we had on that survey. Number one, you're not alone. And the last thing I would say is, number two, you're not intended to live this way. This is not God's best for you. This is not his intent for us to live this way. There is a biblical way of freedom. There is a God-honoring, biblical way of freedom, to freedom, if you and I today are willing to embrace it. And that's the key. Because by embrace it, I mean that there is a way the Bible talks about God, and there's a way that God, that the Bible talks about resource, and a way that the Bible talks about money, and the way that the Bible talks about you and I and our interaction with money and our relationship to it. And I have found this to be true, and I'm sure there were others in the room that would attest to this fact, that this way of being, the way that the Bible talks about, the relationship that we are to have with resource and money, the biblical way towards freedom, this way of living, this way of being in the world is only experienced and it only becomes a reality in our lives as it is lived out. Month by month, moment by moment, paycheck by paycheck. This is one of those realities. This is one of those truths of Scripture that in theory, I imagine in theory, I would be able to convince you of it. Theoretically, you're like, that sounds true, that sounds right in theory. But it must be experienced in practice and not in theory. Because it can only be known. Freedom can only be known when it is felt, when it is lived out, when it is practiced. This is when freedom, I believe comes. And so, really, whatever I'm going to say today about this and what we're going to look at in the Bible about this today and probably on into next week as well, it really isn't worth the breath that I'm using to say it if this is not actualized and lived out in our individual and our corporate lives together. And I'll warn you that embracing freedom and rejecting slavery as it pertains to our finances will take two things. One, a concerted effort on our part. This does take effort and it does take discipline. And it is also a calculated risk. But my goodness, I say risk, but it's really not a risk when we're dealing with the Lord and his faithfulness to us. And really what I'm talking about here at its fundamental level is it means embracing and choosing one particular story over another. And when I say choosing to live one particular story over another, what I mean by that is there is a way of living. There is a way of interacting with money. There are actually a couple of different ways I see in our society. And you and I, every day, choose one of those stories. And I'll also say this is not always popular. Anytime you talk about things like this, I get right away, These are not always popular ideas or popular things within American Western culture to talk about. But lucky for you, I gave up popularity in seventh grade when I cut the mullet. And so I left the pursuit of popularity far behind. And I am far more concerned now with what does the Lord say, what does his word say, than winning any popularity contest. So let me start here. Let's go back to last week. Because I know many of you were traveling in different places last week, and so I wanted to kind of go back to last week because I believe this week builds right off of last week. Last week, I mentioned these two stories. And last week, we spent extensive time looking at a biblical theology of these two stories, two very different stories that are being told in our world as it pertains to money and finance and on resource, and every one of us in this room today by how we live, by the decisions we make, dollar to dollar, paycheck to paycheck, month to month, every one of us is living into one of those stories. It's become our narrative. It's become the way that we respond. And the first story, the first of the two stories, is this story, or really what 84-year-old biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann from Columbia Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, calls the myth, not necessarily a story, he calls it a myth of scarcity. And by scarcity, we mean quite simply this idea that there is not enough, or that in some way there's not going to be enough, and that story, that narrative fuels and informs how we then use resource and how we then use our money. We talked about this about a month ago, but many of us wake up to this story. We wake up and this becomes the defining narrative of our lives from our very first thought, because we wake up and our first thought is we did not get enough what? Sleep. We're already tired. We're already living from a deficit. We're already living in scarcity. We've only been up 3 seconds. Because when we look at our alarm clock, we go, oh my goodness, I didn't get enough sleep. Or could it possibly be that time? And we go on from there. And throughout our day, it's, well, I didn't have enough time. There's not enough time in the day. I don't have enough energy. I don't have enough patience, perhaps, with my students or with my children or with my roommates. I don't have enough patience. I don't have enough education to get the places that I want to be. And I don't have enough resource. There's not enough money. There's not enough resource for us to live how we want to live and do what we want to do. And so from the very beginning, many of us wake up, and that's the defining narrative of our day. Scarcity. Not enough. And Brueggemann calls that a myth. This story, this myth, is like it's like rocket fuel for fear and anxiety when it comes to money, isn't it? I mean, that story is rocket fuel. That will provide some, that will energize fear and anxiety, which then leads us away from freedom when it comes to finances and money, and it leads us into slavery. And this story is also what fuels then a lust or a love affair for more. I just need more. That would be the answer. The answer to the fear, the answer to scarcity would be more. If I just had more sleep, more time, more money, more education, more experience, more resource, then all the fear would go away, right? And that's the myth. That's the lie. This lust for more, it fuels our market economy. We see that, and we'll see that on display very starkly in the next few weeks. This fuels consumerism. Consumption becomes the goal. Profit becomes the motivation. And this fear of not having enough, this fear of if I just had more, then I would have enough, is what will fuel much of that. I want to go back to a quote, Brueggemann, because I've been so kind of profoundly affected by what he wrote. He actually wrote an essay about this at the turn of the millennium, speaking to the next generation of Christian leaders. And here's what he wrote. I put this quote up last week, but I believe it's so prophetic that it deserves 2 weeks. He said this, what we're talking about, consumerism is not simply a marketing strategy. It has become a demonic spiritual force among us. And the theological question facing us is whether the gospel has the power to withstand it. And I believe it does. I believe the gospel does have the answer. It's telling a very different story, which we'll get to in a minute. Because the gospel is the story that begins not with scarcity, but with abundance, right? It begins, the gospel begins with the abundant love of a good God who is always and who is forever generously giving love away. That's the story, that's where the gospel story starts. And so then it fuels this second story. And the second story that's being told, and the second story that I just so wish that we as a community and as individuals and as families and as students and wherever stage of life you are in, if we could embrace this story, it has the power to set us free. And it's the story of God's generous abundance, of a God who promises that there will always be enough. that he will always provide. Not everything that we want, not everything that our neighbor has, not everything that a consumeristic culture tells us that we need, but we'll have everything that the kingdom of God says that we need. He will supply, we read last week, all that we need. This story says that this generous God, who is good, he loves the world so much that what does he do? John 3:16, for God, he loves the world that he does what? He gives, he gives, he gives. He gives his son, who gives his life, who gives us hope, who gives us a future, and who can give us freedom when it comes to our finances. It's all about him giving. It's a totally different story. One story is about consumption. One story fuels consumption. The other story fuels what? Generosity and giving it away. It's a story that rejects scarcity and consumption at every turn and taps in to God's abundance and his generosity. More on that next week, because I want to spend all next week talking about that part of the story. I mentioned this in brief last week, but we see this story of scarcity playing itself out in the Bible itself. And I want to kind of take us back there to what I mentioned in brief last week, but I feel it needs a deeper dive. I feel we need to dig a little bit deeper into that particular story toward the end of Genesis. And so let's just take a little bit of time today and examine a story of scarcity. And I want to examine the story of scarcity because I want to show you how it always leads to slavery. When that story becomes the narrative by which you make financial decisions and by which you live your life and by which you handle resource, it will always lead you into slavery. And it will always leave you in fear. It will drive anxiety. Because the first step to freedom might be to realize that you actually are enslaved. That may in fact be your first step toward freedom. So we read the first 40 chapters of the Bible. And when we read the first 40 chapters of the Bible, really it's a celebration of God's abundance. I mean, the first two chapters alone are this beautiful, poetic celebration of this good, generous, abundant God who commands his creation to be fruitful and to multiply his goodness and his blessing. And he's filling the earth. And he's benevolent, and he's filled the earth with his abundant goodness, and he's commanded humanity, he's commanded us to go and spread his blessing, his vitality, his life to the whole world. And the earth is brimming with fruitfulness for about 40 chapters. It's anything but scarce, which tells us something about the God who set this all in motion, right? I mean, if that's how the Bible begins, if that's the story the Bible is telling, it tells you something about the God who's inspiring it all. And then in chapter 41, though, we get to Genesis chapter 41, and we meet a new character in the story, the king of Egypt, otherwise known as the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh has, I spoke to the children today about dreams, honestly, I felt like that was from the Spirit, and a few of them, I don't know if you saw, a few of them raised their hands because... on a side, you know, I don't know if your kids are having those issues, at least one of ours has been telling us with his dreams, pray over them. Let's continue just to bless them and pray over them and that the enemy would have no foothold in their life. Another sermon, another time. Back to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's having dreams. He's having a couple dreams, actually, remember, in chapter 41. And it's interesting that these two dreams seem to pit scarcity and abundance. It's like scarcity versus abundance, which leads to this dilemma. Let's read it together in Genesis 41. Starting in verse 1, it says, when two full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. Oh, and the ancients believed that dreams told the future. And so there was always, if you were having a consistent dream, the worldview that the ancients shared was that this, in fact, was a window into your future. And so Pharaoh is having these dreams. He was standing by the Nile. When out of the river, there came up seven cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the river bank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the seven sleek and fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. Okay. Bizarre dream, right? Seven fat cows, seven ugly cows, and the ugly ones eat up the fat ones. And then I woke up. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. Seven heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing in a single stalk. After them, seven other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven healthy, full heads. Then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. Two bizarre dreams. A dream about abundance and plenty, and a dream about what? Well, in the same dream, two elements, abundance versus scarcity. And what wins? And scarcity wins in these two dreams. The ugly ones, the gaunt ones, devour the healthy, fat ones, the ones with the grain that was unhealthy, swallow up the healthy, full heads, and then he wakes up. Now, if we read further, Pharaoh is really troubled by these dreams. I mean, he is like seriously troubled, and he has to know what these two dreams mean, and he searches for an interpretation, and he goes to all of the magicians and the wise men of Egypt to say, what does these dreams mean, but to no avail. And then his cupbearer, the person that hands him his wine, says, you know what, I spent some time in county jail with this one kid. He was this Hebrew kid, and he was really good at dream interpretation. I can't remember his name. It was like Johnny, Jimmy, Joey. Joey. It was Joey. Joey something, and he had this really crazy story about his brother throwing him in a pit, and he ended up, it's like, you know, we just swapping stories. How'd you end up? Well, my brother threw me in a pit, and I ended up here. And he said he was, and then things got really bad for him, and then really good, because he became this, like, high official in Potiphar's house, but then he got totally thrown under the bus by the guy's wife, and sold out, and so he ended up in jail. But God was using him, and even in jail, to interpret dreams and even save some of our lives. And he says, you should talk to Joey. And so they go get it. So Pharaoh's like, well, I want to talk to this Joe kid, this Hebrew boy, Joseph. If you're like, who is Joey? I don't remember Joey in the Bible. Friend of Chandler. And and Joseph ends up interpreting the dream. Remember, Joseph gets called up. He's like, what's the story? He tells them the two dreams about the fat cows and the sleek cows and about the grain and the heads. He's like, oh, yeah, I know what that means. And Joseph just gives Pharaoh, very powerful, powerful man, the interpretation of these two dreams, which are essentially about scarcity versus abundance. He tells the Pharaoh, God is going to provide enough, actually. In the dream, he says, God's going to provide enough. There will be abundance for 7 years. There's going to be fat cows for 7 years. There's going to be abundance. And then things are going to get a little tight. And there's going to be the potential that the scarcity is going to win. And that scarcity is going, and that people are going to die. But not, you know, Joseph's point is, it's going to get a little bit tight, but not to worry, because if the 7 years of abundance are managed properly and wisely and rightly, there will be plenty for all, even when things get scarce. And scarcity doesn't have to win. And so it's kind of a warning and an encouragement, and Joseph gives this interpretation because we all know that there are times and there are places and there are situations when it is scarce, right? Let's just be honest. There are times when you get the bank statement and you do a double take, not because you have so much, but because it went that small again this month, when it just seems scarce. And there are those times when all is going well until the transmission dies on your car, right? You're in a very good financial place. And then the transmission happens to go out. Ours went out a year and a half ago in Lake Tahoe on our family vacation, where the mechanic said, oh, it's either a $500 easy repair or it's about a $5,000 total rebuild. Okay, that's how we started our family vacation. Let's go have fun and spend money on vacation now, right? Fear, anxiety. It was the $500, by the way. But for someone in the room, it's going to blow, right? The transmission goes out, and you're like, it seriously costs that much to rebuild? The car's not even worth $5,000. Just take it, right? I'm not going to pay $5,000 to rebuild something that's worth like 700 or whatever. You're like, or you get that, you know, my copay only covered 20%, or, you know, my deductible was 20%. And how much does it cost to get stitches? It's okay. Really? You have one of those experiences, or tuition's going up again? My goodness, how often is, you know, it keeps climbing and climbing, and what's a supplemental tax bill? You know, you get one of those in the mail, supplemental tax bill. I thought we already paid our taxes. Oh no, this was an additional one. And immediately it's like the fear of scarcity is just like hovering, isn't it? Oh, there's not enough. And there are also those places in the world where there simply doesn't seem to be enough, right? Some of you have been to those places. Food is scarce. There is not enough food. It seems that there is not enough food to feed this many people in this village. There is not enough adequate clean water. People are drinking dirty water. Clean water is scarce. Clothing is scarce. Shoes are scarce. Some of you have been in those villages and put shoes on those feet where it just seems scarce. Adequate housing is scarce. Education is scarce. And so those are some of the realities that we live in, 7 years of scarcity kind of realities. And so the question then becomes, does that now mean that God in some way has ceased to be who he was or who he is and what he has promised to do? When we face scarcity, when we face the reality of, yeah, this isn't good, does that mean in some way God is not good? He's not generous? He's not taking care of those people. He's not providing. I don't see shoes on their feet. I see things getting worse for these people. And it brings up those kinds of scarcity versus abundance kind of questions. Is he now not good, not generous, not abundant? Is he not providing for those people? Quick aside. For those of you who have been those places, who have been to those places or seen those videos on YouTube or the photographs in the magazines, and you've been on those streets, I think you, like me, would attest to the fact that if you have eyes to see, you will find in those places the work of God moving forward, and in whispering, there's enough, there's enough, there's enough. You will find that. Every year I walk the same streets in the Dominican Republic, and many of you give me shoes to put on the feet. And I walk the same streets every year. I'll be there in 2 months. And every year I walk those streets, and in the back of my mind, yes, I have that dialogue. Is there enough? Is there enough for these people? Are we doing enough? Why are they hungry? Why are we taking them food? This seems to be like scarcity. I thought the word promises enough, and this looks like scarcity. And so I'll have that, and I'll be honest, some days I walk those streets quite sad, and many of you have walked sad streets and had those same kinds of thoughts. And yet, if you have eyes to see, I'll never forget 2 years ago, walking those streets, I've done this 10 years in a row, never noticing as I walk those same streets, tiny little hole-in-the-wall churches, like all over that community, speckled within that community, all these little churches. And as I was walking the streets, you know what I heard whispering back to me as I'm having those not enough thoughts? There's enough. There's enough. My people are here. They're doing my work here. There's enough. There is enough. The issue is never, is there enough? The issue has less to do then with God's goodness and God's generosity and God's abundance. The issue has everything to do with whether his people are going to reflect that. That's the issue. It's not whether or not he's good, he's generous, or there is enough. It's, is his church, is that going to be our priority? Or are we going to live out of another story because we're in another culture that pushes that story? Which story are we going to live out of? There is enough if God's people grab hold of that story. Okay, that was a totally side sermon. Back to Genesis now. Joseph. So in this story of there always being enough, in chapter 41, we're hit smack dab with the fact that, oh no, there's 7 years of famine. There's not enough. And so it seems like the whole biblical story of abundance and goodness has been thrown into a bit of a quandary. And you're like, okay, so what is that? Does this mean that scarcity wins? Is that just the reality that we face? But it doesn't seem to sneak past God, does it? Because he's got one of his guys already on it. Joey's on it, right? Joseph actually gets released from prison. Joseph gets put in charge of this plan, this whole project of providing in the 7 years of abundance. And so that by the end of chapter 41, you have the following happen. It says this, when the famine did come, when the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians. For the famine was severe throughout Egypt, and all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph. Because the famine was severe everywhere. But even in the midst of severe trial, and even in the midst of scarcity, there's what? There's enough. There's enough. God is faithful to his word. There is enough. We find enough. And enough not just for Egypt, but for who? The whole world. There is enough. Now, I wish I could say the story ends there. Let's go eat and it all ends happily ever after. But we got to finish the story. Because the truth is, fear is a powerful force that can be rather destructive, can't it? Martin Niemöller was a German pastor who heroically opposed Adolf Hitler and his Third Reich Party in 1933. When as a young man, he led a delegation of evangelical Lutheran church leaders to go meet with Hitler. And he recounts that in the meeting they had with Hitler, he stood silently in the back of the room and just listened as a 33-year-old young church leader. Just listened to Hitler talk and said nothing, looking on. Later that evening, when he went home, his wife asked him how the meeting with Hitler went and what he learned. And his quote was this. Here was his response. I discovered that Mr. Hitler is a terribly frightened man. I discovered, he said, listening to him, the guy's a terribly frightened man. There is a power when you lead out of fear, a destructive power, to do much, much harm. And unfortunately, Pharaoh, like Hitler, who would come after him, operates like many tyrants do, leading out of fear. And the results are devastating and the results are ruthless. Because if you read on in the story of Genesis, eventually the crops continue to fail. And in the first year of scarcity, everybody's pretty happy and there's enough and everyone's sharing. And it's like, we're going to make it, we're going to make it, we're going to make it. But what happens in year 7? What happens when people start to panic? Because what eventually happens is the crops continue to fail and as things get more and more scarce, Egypt, led by the Pharaoh, begins to hoard. And they begin to look towards their own self-preservation as a country. They begin to operate in an entirely different way and protect their own interests and resources. And so they end up taking collateral for food. So they start taking collateral, and first they take is land from people, and then they take their cattle. And then when the people, including those who've come from all over the world, including the Hebrew people, have nothing left to give, what do they take? They take them. And scarcity leads to what? Slavery. Buying into the myth of, they were going to have enough. If they were just faithful, they were going to have enough. And we can only assume that Joseph is simply carrying out Pharaoh's commands when we read the following 6 chapters later. So Joseph bought all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh. The Egyptians, one and all, sold their fields because the famine was too severe for them. The land became Pharaoh's, and Joseph reduced the people to servitude from one end of Egypt to another. The fear of not having enough will always lead you into slavery. Pharaoh shows us where that story will take you, or where it will take an entire nation if it's not pushed back on. Because this story has moved from a story of abundance and freedom to a story of scarcity and slavery. And that has been a very, very hard story for we humans to shake in the last few thousand years, hasn't it? That is a hard story to stop living under. And so as we kind of look towards the future here, because I do want to pick this up next week, and next week I want to talk all about freedom solutions towards freedom. Let me preview it now. And just with a few questions. Are there any ways? This is what the things that it makes me think about as I read the scriptures and think about these things. I start thinking, are there any ways that you feel like you've embraced a story of scarcity and you're living out of that with the fear, this constant fear that the famine is going to be your end, that the ball's going to drop, it's going to happen, The bill's going to come. It's going to come crashing down in a moment. And so it's led you into a kind of mental slavery, and maybe not just a mental slavery, maybe it is quite literally slavery to the next bill, slavery to the next paycheck and what you do not see coming in because you've bought into that story. And is this fear of not having enough, needing more, is it enslaving you? Is it keeping you from living in the freedom that God has always intended for you to reflect his goodness and his generosity? And maybe you're sitting here, let's be honest, and say, how would I even know? How would I even know? What does it even look like to live financially free? What does it even look like to trust God's abundance and his goodness? And let me just end with this, because I think this is where it starts. And I'll spend all next week talking this way. I think it starts with having an entirely different perspective of what financial freedom looks like. We have a very cultural understanding of what financial freedom looks like. I think it starts there. Do I need an entirely different view of what financial freedom even looks like? And again, this will depend on which story you're choosing to live out of. Because one story says, the first story, the story of scarcity, says that financial freedom would come if you just had more, right? That would be it. The fear would be gone, freedom would be yours if you had a little bit more. That would be it. That having more would set you free from the reality of not having enough or the fear of not having enough. That's what the myth of scarcity would tell you. That's the solution. That's where you would find freedom. And the amazing thing is, the other story, the story of God's generous goodness and abundance, that story says the opposite. That story would say that financial freedom comes with trusting and blessing and giving more. Then you'll be free. That would actually set you free from the fear of not having enough. It's this idea, and like I said, that God's abundance transcends the market economy in such a way that we can give and we can bless, and in doing so, something really, really cool happens. We're set free. We're set free from the fear. It has no grip on us any longer because that's not the story we're tied to. And this, as I said in the beginning, you can only know through experience. You cannot understand this in theory. It makes sense on paper, I get it. It makes sense to say, I kind of get that, I guess. You will never know this unless you try this, unless you live into that story. It must be lived out month by month, paycheck by paycheck. I can say, as someone who's been trying our darndest in a marriage for almost 19 years to live out of that second story and to have our children living out of that second story, that there has been an incredible freedom that has come for us and always has been there every time we tap into God's generous, abundant nature and do as he does. It just sets us free. And not only is there an incredible freedom, I'll say this, there's incredible potential. There is incredible potential for a church like ours, for a church to be the enough in a world that is living not enough. That the church has it, we say, but there is enough, you see. And so there's this potential, if we all buy into this, if everyone begins living into that story, to say, we are the enough. We are the answer. In a world where there's not enough. And so the church must be a place where people can find enough in a world of scarcity. And so I think it's time just to start walking in this kind of freedom. It may be, in fact, time to leave Egypt again. I don't know. Rainier, why don't you come on up? I can smell soup, can you? I'm sitting here like, man, wrap this thing up, Jacob. There's soup to eat. Next week, I feel like we need to talk again. Next week, I just want to talk freedom. Today was more of that. Let's talk about that first story. Let's talk about that story of scarcity. Let's deal with that. And if there's areas of fear, next week, I just want to talk about the joy of freedom, that second part of that story, and how you experience this month by month, paycheck by paycheck, year by year. And I know you have stories too. I want to hear some of your stories too. that, man, I was set free when we started doing this. This set me free. Don't we have a song about being set free? Oh, yeah, we do, don't we? That'd be a good one to do next week again. But let's just spend a moment. Let's just ask the Spirit of God if there's anything he needs to say, anything he needs to do in this room before, I don't know, I'm supposed to give instructions on lunch. I heard it's supposed to start in about 10 minutes, and so I'll bless that as well. But Holy Spirit, we come to you now. Would you give us faith to embrace your story, the story of your kingdom, your dream for the world? And we know that sometimes that stands in stark opposition even to the American dream. And we're forced to make choices with how we use our money and how we use our resource. But Lord, would you push back against that fear of scarcity, that fear of not having enough? In any ways, if it's gripped anybody in this room today where they're just struggling with that and saying, I can't tap into that because I'm so locked into the fear. Or just the reality that, man, it's tough and times are tough. I pray, Spirit of God, would you whisper in a way that we can hear you over and over again, there's enough, there's enough, trust me, there's enough. And would you put together a group of people, your church, that would be those kind of people that live out that story in a way that speaks volumes to our community, to a community that's going to rush to stores to stockpile even more in the weeks to come. Would you raise up a community that's living a counter-testimony to that? That's living a counter-cultural way. That's teaching our children the way of your kingdom, not the way of consumerism. The way of generosity, not the way of consumption. And so would you set us free? And don't just do this for one or two of us. Do it for our whole community. Raise up a church that's known in the community. Oh, you're just those people that are constantly giving it away. They're just constantly showering blessing upon the world. We want to be that kind of community. We want to speak that kind of counter-testimony with our lives. And so, God, would you do a deep work? Would you push back this fear in Jesus' name? Would you expel this fear? And would you open us up that we can scream freedom? You've set us free. May we live freely with what you've freely given. Freely you give, freely we give. What a joy. What a blessing. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord.
This message was brought to you by Vineyard Church Glendora, a community of worship and compassion. For more information, please visit www.vineyard-church.com.